Hi, this is Caden, and this is my daddy's podcast called Lasting Learning.
Welcome to Lasting Learning, the podcast that was started because I thought I had things to say. The podcast that continues to grow because we've learned that your stories matter more. Welcome to Lasting Learning, where we explore great people doing extraordinary things, sharing with us the lasting lessons they've learned along the way. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Lasting Learning Podcast. I'm excited about today's episode. You know, it is rare that I bring back a guest for a second time or a third time, because I want to try to introduce you to new people. I want to try to expand your network. But today, I am bringing back a guest. But it's a guest that we haven't talked to in a few years. Well, you haven't heard from on this show in a few years. She and I have had the opportunity to connect a little bit. And I'm honestly going to say she is a new person from the person that was here 3-4 years ago. Today, our guest is Connie Hamilton. If that name sounds familiar, you've heard her in podcasts all over the place. She is an author of all things, and we'll talk about all the things that she has written and all the collaborations she's had. You might have worked with her in your school. You might have seen her at a conference recently, or maybe you listened to episode 88. Yeah, it was episode 88 here on the Lasting Learning Podcast when you might have been introduced to her the first time. Her episode here on the Lasting Learning Podcast was actually the last episode released before the pandemic. Before COVID, her episode went out and we had no idea that the world was going to shift and change and dramatically change everybody's world. And I think a lot of you listened to that episode. You binged listened during the pandemic because that episode is still in the top 10 of all episodes released on this network. So super happy to have Connie back here today, who is changing the world, spending a lot of time in the great state of Michigan and all places around North America. Connie, thank you so much for finding time to connect today and share your wisdom with all of us.
Well, thanks for opening up your audience to me again.
Absolutely. You've got a lot that you can share with us, and you can grow us and push us and challenge us, inspire us. You know, one of the things that I love about you, I've seen you present, I've seen you share with the masses, right? I've seen you at some of the biggest conferences out there where you've got crowds of multiple hundreds of people sitting in a room with you. And you and I both know that adult audiences, teacher audiences especially, can be some of the hardest audiences to entertain and engage with. Mm-hmm. But you get people out of their seats, out of their comfort zones, smiling, laughing, making these memories because you are just such an incredible presenter and such an amazing educator. So I'm excited for the people that are listening to this today. If you're listening to this in bed, be prepared. You might be getting out of your seat and doing some activities. If you're driving a car, just remind yourself 10 and 2, even if Connie asks you to do some crazy things, try to stay focused. But know that she can inspire and change you outside of the podcast space as well. So what have you been up to the last couple of years, Connie?
Well, I've been writing like mad. During COVID, I think I overcommitted a little bit to what I might be able to do as far as projects go. And I've been lucky to write with, to co-author some books. And so I've been able to connect with some new people like you. I always appreciate partnering with new folks. And I was able to get out maybe what I might call a sequel to the Hacking Questions book, which is Hacking Group Work. It's kind of an undertone within the questioning, and it's about how to engage learners with each other and be a little more student-centered than teacher-centered. So that's a book that I wrote solo. So there have been just a lot of projects. I have another one coming out next month where I wrote with TJ Varey, Joseph Jones, and Todd Whitaker. Mm. And that book is, it's called Invest in Your Best. And it's another one that was just, it's been in me. Like, I've been wanting to write about how to support the best teachers for a long time. I have the privilege of working in really intimate settings with teachers most of the days of the school year. Like you said, I do workshops and conferences, and I do back to school PD and PD days and that kind of stuff. But most of my days are with six teachers in a school that I see repeatedly through the school year, and a different teacher teaches each time. And it's during those times that I can have an ear. And when I am in the presence of really amazing teachers, one of the most common comments that is kind of heartbreaking is that they don't always get great feedback. They aren't always pushed by others to continue to achieve. And so they have to dig it within themselves, which they're always capable of doing. But it's always kind of nice to have somebody on the outside saying, have you ever thought of this? Or here's something that might challenge you, or here's how you can take your strength and expand it or deepen it. And most of the time I hear they get a bit of the keep up the good work, because other people are just focused on problems. And our best teachers are not problems, but they're the hole they leave when they move on to something else is a ginormous problem. And those people are really, really hard to replace. So I've been really thinking a lot about what are some of the ways that we can retain the best teachers and keep them in the classroom and not use them as a model or a principal's pet type of thing, but really more as just inspiration and spreading what they have. How can we open the doors without making them be the teacher of teachers?
That's so good. You're collaborating on that project with lots of people. Todd Whitaker, one of my favorite people in the world, reminds us that as a leader, your job is to come up with policies and procedures with the best of us in mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that mindset of really framing how can you support the best? And I know best is a subjective term. We all have criteria for what makes somebody, quote unquote, the best. But there are a lot of us that think the job of the best is to go out and support the least. And we put more burdens on them. We do this as teachers sometimes in our classrooms when we think about that advanced kid, that kid that already has all the answers. And we say, now your job is to go help everybody else. We do it the same within the system as leaders to teachers. You're doing all the things, so I'm just going to throw more things on your plate to cover up for those that aren't doing it. And I love that you are truly leaning in and listening to these teachers that are saying, I need help too. I need support. You know, the thing that put you on the map for a lot of people was hacking questions, right? Hacking questioning and getting people to understand how to start asking intentional questions. How to get yourself in a position to truly listen to other people. Because it's one thing to ask a question. It's another thing to truly listen to responses.
Right.
And I see that that's what you're doing. You're putting your message and putting it into practice with teachers in these intimate settings, 5, 6, 7 teachers sitting around a table, oftentimes the quote unquote best of us. And you're really leaning in and listening and saying, how can I serve you? And how can I support you more? Mm-hmm. And I love that you're doing that. And you've been doing that since the beginning. But intentionally over the last 3 or 4 years, the pandemic caused a lot of us to pause and shift and start leaning in and truly listening to those people that have stayed in the profession. So what are you learning about education today? What is different about education today, even pre-pandemic, that you're trying to tap into?
I think it's a little more challenging. I think apathy, student apathy, is really prevalent. And even some of the most experienced teachers that have overflowing toolboxes are finding that even the strategies that go to are not reaching every learner. And so trying to figure out like how do we reach these students post-pandemic who have had more flexibility in their time, who have been able to take a break whenever they need, like go do this or that, or hey, it's time for snack, or not have to collaborate, be able to do things independently, have a lot more autonomy, but perhaps not as much rigor. You know, how are we building their stamina to stay in school for 6 hours? And I know we've been back for a while, but it lingers. And, you know, I think of my sister has 2 young kids. My kids are grown, but my sister has 2 young kids, and my niece was in first grade during that the 2021 school year. That's not true. She was in second grade during that year, but she was in first grade at the end of the pandemic. And I remember thinking like, I don't know how she's ever going to catch up. Like those months are so precious at developing as a reader. the one-on-one, the side-by-side reading, all of those things that are just really challenging to replicate. And that absence continues to linger. She's in fifth grade now, but it's still present.
I've had conversations with some people that take a different approach to that. And I'm curious to hear your response. There are some people that would say, well, maybe it's to our advantage now that we respond to that and we recognize that kids, just like adults, don't want to just be sitting behind their desk for 6 or 7 hours a day, that they don't want to just jump through the hoops. We saw this mass exodus of teachers, and a lot of them went into the small business and entrepreneurship and these jobs where they could start working remotely and have more flexibility, because that's everybody's dream, is to be able to carry their own torch and figure out their own path. And now we just have kids saying, we want the same thing. Mm-hmm. Is it important for us to try to get kids to go back to what was, or is it more important for us to respond to what they're telling us now that they need?
Well, I think both. I mean, as far as when I think of the what was, I don't necessarily think about the teacher, like that I was never an advocate of the teacher centered kind of, you know, raise your hand, answer a question like that. That never was a goal in my mind as a what was. However, I do think that there is a certain level of scaffolding and support and connection and rigor that we offered, that when the pandemic came, the focus was more around the social and emotional components, and the content became that the secondary component. So I think equalizing those areas, making sure that, you know, to throw out a buzzword, that we're educating the whole child, that we are really mindful about where are they socially, where are they emotionally, where are they mentally, and where are they academically, and how can we help them to be comfortable with challenge? I think that there was a little bit, it felt like there was a little bit more comfort in being faced with challenge than there is now. And so building that, I don't want to say growth mindset because that is like a bastardized term now. It doesn't really mean what it used to mean, but that like stick with itness, building that stamina and perseverance, that's, I think, is what has fallen and that a lot of educators struggle with. How do I deal with that? Because that's not a content expectation. That's not a learning target, right? But that is interfering with my ability to teach, whether it's face-to-face, if it's online, if it's a hybrid, that is present. And that's a barrier.
No, I think you're spot on. I was talking with a group that I was working with just yesterday. We were working with this group from Louisville, Kentucky. And we had this conversation around how in the 90s, 2000s, even before that, the focus was on the three R's, the reading, writing, arithmetic of education. And then we went through this transformative phase that started about a decade ago, where we started focusing on the five C's and really focusing on critical thinking, creativity, collaboration, communication, those sorts of things. And now we're at this place in education where a lot of people are worried about the intrusion, to use their word, of artificial intelligence and how AI is going to change education, because it's going to allow kids to just, quote unquote, cheat. It's going to allow it's going to replace educators in the workspace. But those people that are fearful of that are those that are still grounded in education is all about reading, writing, arithmetic, regurgitation, recall, as opposed to collaboration, communication, creativity, critical thinking, which is truly the responsibility of an educator to facilitate that kind of learning. And it's something that AI can't replace. It's something that we don't have to worry about AI getting in the way of kids, quote unquote, cheating, when we're focusing on those skills. And that's at the heart of asking critical questions. It's at the heart of engaging your students and not just forcing this compliant driven mindset. And I think that's truly where we are right now. One of the things that came out of the pandemic was this amazing opportunity now for us to say, we've got to change our focus. We've got to change what we've been looking for. And sometimes to create change, you have to have this sense of urgency that we now have, that people like you can step in and say, oh, now let me tell you how I can support you in focusing on the things that matter. These are things that were a priority, at least in word and in mindset pre-pandemic. But now we're seeing the essential need to jump on board, questioning, engagement, getting kids to collaborate. So I'm curious right now in your space, when you're working with small groups of teachers or large groups of teachers, and you start talking about terms like engagement, do you see that teachers understand what that truly means? Or do they think it means standing in your head, juggling in front of kids and putting on a show?
I think there's a blend, you know, that there's a group of people that think it's like edutainment and, you know, that we're trying to turn ourselves into video games so that kids can be entertained and draw them in. And, you know, that's pretty easy to debunk. I also think that there's also a small group that views engagement as just not having discipline issues. Like, as long as the kids behave, they're engaged. If they're quiet, then they're listening, right? We don't have any evidence that kids are actively listening if we don't engage them in showing that they can apply what they have heard. So I think what you said about AI, it really kind of drives home. And I'm a fan of teacher clarity and like being really, really purposeful about what it is that you want kids to know and how they're going to show it. And we often focus on the task that students are going to do or the project that they're going to complete as evidence of their learning. And so if AI is a concern that kids are going to cheat, then we have to change the task that allows them to show what it is that they know. So instead of the final product being an essay or a paragraph or whatnot that, yeah, in 2.5 seconds, AI could print out for them, then if we can just pause for a moment and try to problem solve, like recognize, yep, that's what is likely to happen. And what, not how can we prevent that from happening, but how can we still allow students to show what they know, given the tools that are available to them? So instead of having that final product be a summary paragraph, give them three summary paragraphs. And have them identify, like, if you were going to subscribe to one of these AI programs, which one would you start with? And then show how you edited this piece to bring in your own voice. Like, what did you think was strong about it? What was inaccurate? I mean, when AI first came out, you could Google your name and it would bring out facts about your family, your spouse, probably your stinking dog, right? And it's only going to get better and better and better. So right now we're in the midst of this. It's not perfect, and it's obviously not perfect. And so it's a great opportunity for kids to learn how to be critical, how to look for accuracy, how to do comparisons. I'm really big into comparing quality work. So we think about oftentimes having a rubric of like, this is a one, this is a two, this is a three. I like to look at like, this is a three, this is a three, or let me take that back. This is a two, this is a two, this is a two. Why are they twos and how could they become threes? And just comparing good work, and that brings in the language of success criteria, which is a challenge for a lot of teachers to wrap their head around, is how do I include success criteria for young kids, or how do we allow students to assess their learning through success criteria? I'm getting sidetracked, but
no, I think you're hitting on a powerful point, right? Lots of powerful points. Number one, I mean, we talked a little about AI, and the interesting component about AI and how it's getting better is that, you know, it was put out in the media recently that a lot of the chat bots that people typically think of, like ChatGPT, for example, they have been trained to lie and purport fake information now as well. And we say that it's getting better, but that's one of the components of it actually getting better. I mean, it's a humanistic characteristic. Mm-hmm. We all want to tell the truth, but we don't always tell the truth. We exaggerate. So AI components are starting to get more humanistic. And part of being a human is being able to discern fact from fiction, good from great, quality versus exceptionality. And I love that you're bringing that together. But I also love how you're illustrating, I think, a very important point. I think sometimes people like us or students get compartmentalized. That this is the thing that you're known for. This is the thing that you do. This is your trick. You're the questioning lady. You're the engagement person. You're the standards-based grading person. What you're illustrating, though, is that these things that make people good are actually good because they're so intertwined. You can't ask good questions unless you're focusing on quality engagement. You can't focus on quality engagement and good questions unless you're focused on building a good culture around inquiry. You can't have a good culture around inquiry unless you know how to support the teachers that might do things a little bit more, out of the norm and outside of the tradition. So how do you do that? You look at things through this holistic mindset. And you say one thing leads to the other, which leads to the other, and we're going to keep on going and we're going to keep on growing. And it's this never ending cycle, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of schools, they go and they look for the answer to that problem and they plug and play and say, this is going to be the solution that's going to fix everything. And the reality is most of the time, those solutions are put in place because of, quote unquote, the worst of us mm-hmm. and not the best of us, to try to cover up deficiencies as opposed to enhance excellence. As you go through your work, and think about all the things that people reach out to you for. Do you have a thing that most people reach out and say, oh, Connie, we need you to come work with us on this thing that then opened up Pandora's box and you start exploring all the things?
Yeah, it usually begins with questioning. And I was just talking to a school earlier this week, and as they were talking about they're implementing MTSS and RTI, and you know they wanted to look at tier one instruction, and you know, questioning of course fits into that. And I think that when we can look at questioning through the lens of questioning as a verb, not necessarily the question itself, like we're not. Most of the work that there are other people who do great, like questioning mm-hmm. DOK stuff, but most of mine is around how do you pose questions that cause students to think, cause students to reflect, and encourage questioning as like a good normal thing. If you ask any student right now, why do teachers ask questions? They will most likely say to check and see if I understand. Mm-hmm. They think questions are mini quizzes all the time. And when you go through school thinking that a question is a check for understanding 100% of the time, you are completely missing the value of just being curious and inquisitive and the power of asking yourselves questions and following that so that you can deepen your learning. That's a side of questioning that most kids don't explore in the classroom the way they do on the playground or, you know, in their basement when they're playing with their Legos or even in video games. You know, they're like, hey, let me explore this. I wonder what will happen. How can I do this trick? They're wondering and trying and failing and trying again and failing and trying again. And we think that sometimes these students get bucketed as, you know, they don't have drive or they're not willing to put in the effort, but yet they're putting in the effort on things that they're highly interested in. They have that capability. We just aren't framing questions and engagement in a way that makes it something worthwhile for students. That's where it kind of starts.
Yeah, you're making me think about a lot of things here. So yeah, I've watched Suits. Everybody in America is watching Suits right now on Netflix. And one of the things Harvey Specter says, one of the lead characters in Suits, is that the best lawyers don't put anybody on the stand and they don't ask a question to that person that they don't already know the answer to. And I think there are some teachers that take the Harvey Specter approach to their classroom as well. And they think they have to have all of the answers to all of the questions they're going to ask. Because otherwise, how can they tell a kid if they're right or wrong in this very binary sense of got it, don't got it? Mm-hmm. But what you're proposing is that questioning is more than right, wrong, got it, don't got it.
Oh,
questioning
sure.
is an impetus to curiosity.
Yeah.
How do teachers get themselves comfortable to be in a position where they don't have all the answers to all the things? They're supposed to be the expert in the room, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that exact scenario happens all the time. And usually where I start to try to help teachers to be comfortable with it is just because you know an answer doesn't mean you need to share it. And so inviting students to delay answers for a longer period of time. So we aren't establishing a classroom culture where when a question is answered, there is an immediate answer that is expected or found. Like wonderings can linger. And that curiosity can build. I mean, how many times do you think of something and then you just like, I can't resolve it. I can't think about it. I don't have a solution. And then all of a sudden in the strangest circumstance, you have an aha and you're like, oh, I have clarity around that. We steal that opportunity for kids when we give an answer just because we know it and they don't. So that's the first place that I start is try out, you know what, just have like a little parking lot, just like we do with adults. Hey, you're going to ask a question that maybe is going to go in a different direction, but it's a good question. Let's put that in the parking lot. And when we have a little bit of time, we'll go back to it. My thought is when kids ask those wondering questions, instead of deciding, are we going to go with it and answer it? Or am I going to shut it down? Like park it. You know, that's a really good wondering. You know what? Let's hold on to that. I'm going to write that down. Write it down and just, it could stay there for days. And then you can come back and model and say, you know, this question, I've been looking at it for 4 days. And every morning when I'm in the shower, it just pops into my mind. And today it was a little different. I had a little aha. Did any of you have a little aha about this? Hmm. And now we're modeling like what inquiry and wonder really is. It isn't just Q&A.
So you're speaking my language right now. And you're getting to this place where I think we're going to have this tipping point for a lot of people with a big aha in just a second. But there are also people that hear this and like, okay, that sounds good, but it sounds very liberal artsy. My job is assessed based off of standardized tests. And my students have to take tests at the end of the year because I believe those tests are built around my students' ability to recall factual information. So I just have to dump a bunch of information on them so that they can absorb it and spit it back to the standardized test manufacturers in the spring. And that's how I get evaluated. Yeah, you might have some people that are touchy-feely and think they're supposed to create these lifelong, inquisitive, curious learners, but that's not how I'm judged. That's not how I'm evaluated. How do you respond to that?
I would dare say that you're not being evaluated and judged in that way, because even the assessments are expecting way more than regurgitating information. And as you know, we talked just a bit ago about AI, as that continues to grow, our assessments are going to get better too, and more organic and more authentic. And when you look at any job description, I don't care what the role is, you're looking for people who can collaborate, who can problem solve, who can communicate, who are patient, who are articulate. Like all of those things don't come from knowing one right answer. So we have to be able, if we want to prepare, I mean, I don't even know what those jobs are anymore that have one right answer.
Yeah. You're 1,000% right. Yeah, I think.
Could you say that again? I don't hear that often.
You are absolutely spot on correct here, Connie. You know, I think we create these false paradigms. I'm a big believer that what happens in our classrooms is built around what we assess in our classrooms. The way that we assess becomes how we instruct as well. And there are a lot of teachers that create their classroom assessments, whether we're talking the checks every day or their big, scary assessments at once a quarter or whatever, that they are basically recall and understanding level tests or assessments where they just want to know, can you repeat facts? Can you copy off of me and just memorize the notes that I gave you? Can you put my words into your mouth and put them in different words? And so that becomes how we teach. But I've shared this with a lot of people before. I recently did a study where we examined schools all around the Midwest, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana. We looked at about 12,000 classrooms. And what we recognize is that K-12, 83% of the academic standards ask kids to analyze, synthesize, create, evaluate, these high level tasks, 83% of the standards. But yet 76% of the classroom level assessment and instruction was at the recall understanding level. So because we're building these classroom assessments that ask kids to memorize things, because it's easier for us to, in a very binary way, say, you got it, you don't got it, you're right or you're wrong, we then instruct that way. But when we recognize that the standards, which these standardized assessments are built off of, are actually asking kids to problem solve and to investigate and to be curious, then teaching kids how to ask the questions and how to lean in and actually how to collaborate and how to use outside sources to find possibilities makes a lot more sense. Mm-hmm. So when people reach out to you and say, questioning is a need of ours, how do they even come to that realization? Because I agree, it is a need in a lot of schools and a lot of classrooms, but most people don't even understand that that's a need.
I think they come to that conclusion because they recognize that there's a lot of surface level questions, just like you were describing, rapid fire, yes, no, closed-ended questions. And even in the circumstances when teachers desire and are really putting forth an effort to ask some more open-ended, higher-level kinds of questions, they aren't getting the response that they would like to with the students. And so therefore, the outcome of asking the high-level questions, even when they're present, is over-scaffolding. Kids can't answer it, so I need to figure out how I can help them to be able to answer it. And then before you know it, we're answering our own stinking questions and we're back to lecture. So trying to find that happy medium of, like you said, it's all intertwined, right? You can't just come in and ask high level questions and expect the dynamics of the classroom to change. It has to be a way, it has to be a shift in the way that students view questions, which means we have to change their perception that questions are about, am I right or am I wrong? Mm-hmm. And the way to do that is just to model it, like narrating your questions, like, gosh, I've been really wondering, da da da, and not even seeking an answer, like just let it linger, just let questions and wondering float as often as possible. There was a study that talked about how four-year-olds ask, I wish I could remember now. I want to say something like 100 questions an hour or something ridiculous. It's wicked high. And as they get to the middle school level, it's almost zero questions that students pose. So is that all development, or is there something about the system of education that squashes the genuine curiosity that kids come to us with and leave us without?
So I'm going to say something right now that I'm hoping doesn't overshadow this conversation, because I'm going to throw some stuff out at you and then we'll circle back. But I work with a lot of schools around assessment and how to design assessments, which marries itself to questioning quite a bit.
Sure.
But I share some research with people regarding brain development, neuroscience. We have learned so much about how the brain works over the last decade, just because of our new technologies with MRIs and CAT scans and CTs, be able to truly be able to see what's happening in the brain like never before. You know, there used to be this common belief, this common understanding that the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain, the front of the brain that controls common sense, AKA transference, the last part of the brain to fully develop. We used to think the prefrontal cortex doesn't fully develop until 25 years old, which is why so many of us lack common sense. It's why you can't get a rental car until you're 25, because you'll go out and you make some stupid decisions. Well, as science has evolved and we've started to learn more, we've discovered that that is true. It's a true statistic. The prefrontal cortex doesn't fully develop until 25, but it's only a true statistic here in America.
What we've learned
is that the prefrontal cortex actually starts to develop in utero worldwide, and it continues to develop even through infancy and as a toddler and in early childhood. But here in America, at around the age of 5, it starts to go into this level of dormancy for about 12 years until around the age of 17 or 18, when it starts to come online again and start to rapidly develop for another 7 or 8 years. And the reason, there's lots of reasons behind this. When I first started reading this research, I thought, oh, it's because of school. But then I realized, no, kids go to school all around the world, so it can't be school that's doing it.
No,
but the correlational
American
studies
school.
Have said, boom, it's not just school, it's how we do school. Mm-hmm. And in our schools in America, we don't give kids the opportunity to transfer knowledge, to have common sense, because we're telling them what to think, when to think, where to think. We're telling them who to sit next to, who not to sit next to. We're telling them right, wrong. We're telling them to be forced compliant, as opposed to curious and passionate and investigative. I used to be a leader of a Title I turnaround school, and we used to jokingly say, our kids have street smarts, but not book smarts. Another fancy word for street smarts is common sense and transference.
Right?
They know how to live in the world.
Yeah.
They just don't know how to sit in a seat. Uh-huh. And what you're telling us is that with advanced questioning, you're opening up Pandora's box to that kid's brain. And you're saying, let's get that thing triggering again. Let's truly start to develop that kid's brain so that they don't end up with a freshman year of college like mine was, where I honestly don't remember my freshman year of college because I was a mess. I had no idea what I was doing. So I was waking up passed out in bushes many nights because I had no idea how to live in the world. I didn't know how to ask questions and be curious and figure things out on my own. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine, Jessica Leahy, she wrote The Gift of Failure. Another plug, go check out that episode on here. She talks about building resilient learners, resilient kids, and you have to set them up to say, here's the question. I'm not going to give you all the answers. Let's just see if you can figure this out. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is that begins at the classroom level. It begins at the elementary level, continues through the middle school level, into high school. ask questions, and then sit back and let kids stumble through and figure it out either individually or even in groups and collaboratively, because the world isn't designed for us to be isolated and alone. Mm-hmm. So how do you marry all that? I mean, that's a lot of information I just dumped, so I apologize. And some of that was just probably brand new to you or some of our listeners.
Yeah,
but when you start to hear that, what thoughts go through your mind?
I feel validated.
Yeah.
As you were speaking, part of what came to mind is that you probably have listeners who are inspired by what you just said, and you're like, oh yes, okay, so if this is a problem just here in America, then, and it's not elsewhere, then scientifically it's possible, right? To trigger that prefrontal cortex. The issue, the barrier that is real, is that a single teacher has those kids just for a short period of time. Mm. And if they're in a system where before they come to you and after they leave to you, the system hasn't changed, then yeah, you've given them this opportunity and perhaps inspired, but it really is going to take a bigger awareness and belief.
Yeah.
And some of the pushback that I get is they can't, like they won't, they can't. And perhaps that's true today,
right,
but it doesn't mean that they can't in the future. Like they can't right now, or they won't right now, or they don't know how right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that just, if kids don't know how to read right now, we teach them to read.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't know how to be curious, then why do we not give them opportunities to be curious in a way that is just really organic? There's not a teacher alive that doesn't want students that ask really awesome questions. For crying out loud, when a kid asks a good question, most teachers are like, hey, everybody, so-and-so just asked a really good question and I want everyone to hear it. I mean, we stop the class for good questions. So we do recognize the value. It just isn't as intentional and purposeful to bring it into the classroom. It's more happenstance. And that's part of what I am trying to work with, is to be more intentional, but not ridiculously obvious so that mm-hmm. it looks canned and feels artificial. How do we bring that in a really genuine way?
So good. I'm going to try to bring all of your worlds together here, right?
Okay.
Thinking about the best of us, leadership, engagement, questioning. I'm a big believer that if we want to be better, we have to study people that are better. If we want to become the best, we have to study the best, which one of the reasons why I love talking to you, because you always inspire me to go out there and do things better and think differently and be really investigative. In the history of the world, we've had some amazing teachers, whether it's Socrates, who we now have the Socratic method of teaching that comes from that. When I left high school, I was a 4.0 student, ended up going to law school and was introduced to the Socratic method of teaching. And it blew my mind. And it was so frustrating because my professors just asked questions and never gave answers. And I was so frustrated. But now I think about what I do and the questions I ask, and I attribute it to that. Go around that same time in history, one of the greatest teachers, whether you agree with his teaching or not, changed the course of the world. Jesus, just quick statistic. I just looked this up just for whatever it's worth. In the Bible, it's recorded that Jesus was asked 183 questions. Jesus asked 307 questions. Jesus answered 3 questions. So again, whether you agree with the teachings or not, if you want to become a good teacher that changes a kid's life, informs, inspires, and gets them passionate and curious about something, study the people that have done that for others. And asking questions is a powerful practice aside from giving answers and information. And it also leans into getting kids curious, collaborative, getting adults to be collaborative, collective teacher efficacy. One of the top drivers of student performance, we see this when we look at Hattie's research and collective teacher efficacy, 1.57, which is out of this world when you get teachers to collaborate and lean in and support each other, ask the questions about what matters most. And now you ask students to do the same thing. As you think about your work going forward, the hill that you want to die on, the thing that you want to be known for, what is the thing that you say, teachers, of all else, do this in your classroom? This is going to be the thing that changes kids' lives. Principals, make sure that your teachers are doing this in classrooms. Parents, make sure you're doing this with your kids. Like, what is the thing that Connie wants to be known for?
I want teachers to be intentional and purposeful.
Ooh.
Every decision has a purpose, has an intention, and that we are constantly looking at, did we accomplish what we intended to accomplish? So that reflection is, do we get the results that we expected to get? And if not, why? And still asking ourselves those questions. But that, I think, when we go through the motions and we don't really think about what do we hope to accomplish when we have a bell ringer? What do we hope to accomplish when we skip the lesson closure? What do we hope to accomplish? If we don't consider what our purpose is, then it makes it really challenging to measure success.
That's good. And I think that transfers into so many pieces of life. You know, before I hit record, you and I were talking just a little bit on the business side, and I hope I don't overspeak here when I share some of this, but we were talking about some of the intentionality behind our decisions as to where we go and who we work with and who we don't work with. You and I, we're going to be together right around the time this episode is released. We're going to be together in San Antonio at one of our favorite conferences, Innovative School Summit, shameless plug. But it's a conference that goes all over the country, Nashville, Chicago, New York, Orlando, all over the place. And at that conference, we get to intentionally work with people that come to that conference saying, I want to find somebody that I can work with that can partner with my school. We go to some other conferences where they're networking opportunities, and we know people go there to hang out and socialize. We work with some schools where they have an intentional quest to say, we simply want to change student achievement, which is a goal, but what does that look like? How does that sound? How do we measure success? Teachers that say, I want to be the best teacher without measurable goals and without measurable outcomes. The focus on intentionality, I think, is so, so important. So important. So what are your intentions next year? Where do you plan to be over 2024? I know I'm putting it out there. But where are you going to be? And you might not even be able to answer that. Just again, thinking back to the changes that have occurred over the last 3 or 4 years that you couldn't have predicted, who you are as a person now, who you are as a professional now. But what is your intention for next year?
As I mentioned, I do most of my work is with teachers. And in that work, I have really recognized the need to support administration as well, so that the message that teachers are getting in their professional learning circles is consistent with what they are getting from their leadership. And so I have a couple of schools this year that not only am I working with teachers, but also the administrative team to sharpen their noticing skills and their ability to give feedback that is relevant and actionable. So we're not just saying you should increase engagement and then expecting teachers to just do something with that. And so bringing that common message into a complete school is really one of my goals, and mostly because I've seen the need for it. It's terrible when I'm in there saying, you know, your learning targets don't need to be posted on the whiteboard, and then teachers are snickering in the back saying, oh yeah, here they are. And I don't like to ever throw anybody out under the bus. And so making sure that everyone is learning the same thing together and applying it in a consistent way. Now we're all paddling in the right direction, and we're going to make more progress in a more efficient way.
I love it. Efficiency and effectiveness go hand in hand. It doesn't have to be one or the other.
For sure.
And that focus on intentionality, the purpose behind things. And if your purpose is simply to force compliance, let's try to revisit some things and see if we can't create a purpose that is aligned with effectiveness or efficiency. So good. So good. You are truly changing lives. You are changing schools. I love that you're doing it in these very intimate ways. We're able to lean in and ask people questions, and you stand beside them both as a coach and a consultant to say, let me help you. It's that Jerry Maguire approach. And you're masterful at it. You ask the right questions to get people the answers that they didn't even know that they needed. And you do it in an engaging way where it's not sit and get and listen to Connie's brilliance, which is there, but you get people inspired, you get them fired up, you get them passionate, you give them a motivation and the ability to go out and do the work. So I just appreciate you. I appreciate the journey that you've been on. I appreciate the rebirth and the regrowth and the doubling down and all the things that you have been forced to do and that you've been intentional about doing. You are changing lives, mine, the listeners, people that you meet every single day. So keep doing it. Keep digging in. I'm going to ask that you one more thing before we sign off here. I'm going to ask the listeners to be intentional. Most of us, when we listen to podcasts, we don't do this step. We just listen and click it off and go to the next episode. But I'm going to have a bunch of contact information in the show notes. I'm going to challenge people to be intentional about clicking some of those things, finding you, looking up your website, contacting you, learning more about you, listening to other episodes and podcasts that you've been on. What is the easiest way? What is the most direct thing of all the resources that people are going to be able to see? Where do you want them to go first? Be intentional and say, this is where you need to go.
My website is probably the easiest. There are free resources there. There's some descriptions of the workshops that I've led, and there's a click to contact me if anybody wants to. So it'll give a little bit of an overview, but there's a page on my website that is, it looks like a shopping cart, but everything is $0. And there are tons of free resources there. Everything on the website is free. So if for nothing else, you can find, if you're a teacher, I'm sure you'll find something you can use. And if you're a leader, you'll find something you can pass on. Okay. So that's a good place to start.
That's good. And it's ConnieHamilton.org. So pretty easy to remember. But again, if you can't remember that, click the link, be intentional, go and find the thing that resonates with you. You'll see a lot of different titles, a lot of different things that seem like they cover a lot of different areas. But as we've discussed, they're all connected. So don't just buy one, say, I like that title. Buy everything, read everything, get the free stuff, get the purchase stuff, do it all because it's all part of the process. I don't want you to be left with knocking over one domino and realizing, uh-oh, there's a lot more that I need to do. So continue to explore everything, examine everything that Connie puts out there because it's all good stuff. Connie, thank you so much for being you and engaging with us today and just helping grow and inspire so many people.
Thanks, Dave. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to seeing you in San Antonio, and maybe a few listeners will join us up for a happy hour or something.
Let's do it. Happy hour in San Antonio. Let's get some brisket and beer. Sounds perfect. Yeah. Thanks for checking out this episode of the Lasting Learning Podcast. Want to learn more about what I'm up to? Feel free to check out lastinglearning.net or schmitto.net. If you're brave enough to attempt to spell my last name, you can learn about where I'm at, what I'm doing, who I'm talking to, and who I'm collaborating with. So check it out. You can also check out one of my books. You can check out It's Like Riding a Bike, How to Make Learning Last a Lifetime. Bold Humility, How to Encourage Risk-Taking in Your School. You can check out Making Assessment Work for Educators Who Hate Data But Love Kids. Or check out my newest collaboration with Caitlin Giordano called Poking the Bear, starting the conversations that need to happen in your school and in your classroom.